You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. Today my guest is Juno Diaz. He's the author of a book of stories, a first book of stories called Drown from Riverhead Books. He's been the subject of a lot of attention since even before this book came out. He was singled out as the savior of the next century or something like that by Newsweek magazine.
Yeah, something ridiculous, I think.
I'm curious to begin with how I have a friend who only calls his books by one-word titles, Dennis Cooper with Frisk and all of the others. What made you choose Drown as a title?
I think it goes to, I'm a terrible person for naming my stories. Terrible. My stories, you know, if I don't focus in and just get one word, the longer they are, the more likely there is that they're going to have a car accident. So I tend to, you know, find one word just because, you know, otherwise I hang myself. And Drown itself, I just loved that word and the way that word resonates, because you can't tell if it's a command, drown, or, you know, infinitive, or, and I just, you know, for a Spanish speaker, I can remember hearing that word the first time and how ominous it sounded. And so, you know, outside of the sounds and how, you know, the play within it, I also liked the way it worked in a story, which was about a people, a character, a narrator in a situation where he felt just embedded. He felt almost paralyzed or couldn't get out of.
I like the way it seems like one of the longest vowels in English, drown.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
In that story, he is being, the narrator, seduced by a friend, and what is giving him this underwater feeling is the shock of having sex with another man. I wondered, though, most of the sex in this book feels unhappy or dangerous, and I wondered if there is any happy sex.
Well, you know, I don't know. I think that there's plenty of happy sex. I'm convinced. But
not in your stories.
I don't know about that. I think that these stories were, you know, these stories were a lot about the way people are and the way that people talk and the way that people communicate. And often these narrators, they find it difficult to communicate. You know, they're in a situation that's very demanding, and they often, sometimes they don't have the words, or the silence is too strong. You know, there's still, I guess, I don't know, like things, there's trends, and I feel like things change, and things are always changing. But I think that there are still a lot of silences. You know, the fiction, there's things people still don't talk about. And I think that there is a lot of pride, and now there's a lot of shocking. You know, people will write frankly, like, everyone's a prostitute, everyone's a drug addict. Again, these things are just as easy. They're easy because it's much more difficult to make people to out of these, you know, these brazen statements of like who we are, mm-hmm. These shocking moments. You still have to carve people that a reader is going to care about. And I felt for these stories, you know, the stories that I was working on, but also some of the best fiction out there, you know, it's trying to slide through all that ballyhoo and say like, look, I'm carving people here. We're at work. We're trying to show some hearts. And I think that, you know, that's difficult. Again, it's easy to be like, I'm a prostitute. You know, I dealt drugs or blah, blah. Like, that's the new deal. Mm-hmm. Shock suburban, you know, shock the old mainstream. I often wonder, though, I'm wondering, like, you know, are these full characters? Are we feeling like we really care about these people? Not that we necessarily have to care about them, but are we, like, glimpsing full characters?
Well, this show originates in Los Angeles, and, you know, I talk to a lot of kids. Now, this is an unusual city in that, for the most part, if you weren't born here, you came here on your own steam. And before long, there is a language that immediately says, yeah, I'm a whore. It's almost as if you're not, you better be ready for trouble. Now, in the old days, and I don't mean very long ago, 7 years ago, people would say angrily, you trying to make me into a whore? I don't whore for anyone. I don't whore my work. I don't whore my soul. I don't whore my sexuality. So something has happened in the interim that has made this form of self-definition.
Though I want to throw this back at you, though.
Yeah.
Again, these terms may have lost their valence. They may no longer be charged. I can list 20 terms that young people today would be like, you can't do this to me. I'm not this. No matter what they say about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
There's still terms now, new terms who have been adopted. You know, it depends which coast we are, where we are. Are you a punk? Are you a paraguayo? You know what I'm saying? Are you a sellout? Terms, again, that, you know, like these may not seem so charged. It depends where you're at in your situation and if you hear that amongst your boys or your girls. And I do think that there are new terms every day that get adopted that serve as, you know, guardrails for
mm-hmm.
us. You know, that's not the place. These are the pickets. We will not go beyond these pickets.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And there's people who are transgressor by very nature. They're transgressive. They'll go beyond and beyond and beyond. But, you know, that's not everybody.
Now, do you feel in your own writing that you proceed or follow these disappearances of guardrails? Does writing lead forward or does it report?
A lot of the writing, you know, I feel that it came out of a specific geography. It came out of these specific people. So a lot of times I don't think I'm writing anything that's really super transgressive. I feel like I'm going after lives. And if you have that, you know, and I'm trying to go after like lives that were familiar to me, not lives that were exotic to me, not the strangest, most fringest things, you know. I was like, I wanted just to talk about the basics. I felt like I hadn't even hit the basics yet before I started going on the weird edge, you know. And for me, it was just important to try to get my community down. And so I don't know how much of it is reporting or, you know, how much of it is just this need to bring that community to life, whether as a historical document or as a piece of literature.
Now, these things, in fact, I agree with you, do not seem transgressive to me. They seem to make up a world, and they don't seem to be creating, which is another alternative, a new kind of cool. But I wondered, what is the community that you're getting down?
Well, there's a number of layers. You know, we all live in three or four overlapping worlds. One of them is about this young immigrant family. Again, a family that's dealing with things that people deal with all the time. Jobs, difficulty with jobs, you know, how tough it is to eke it out in this country. Problems between the mother and the father. You know, the father character in these stories, you know. He's a master of infidelity and how that influences this family and how that disrupts the life and immigration. And then there's another level where it's dealing about male culture and just young men, like the children of these families, but just these young men, how they interact, the lives they're dealing with, you know, especially these men of color. They have these jobs and, you know, they're really putting in their time trying to get things to work out. And it's a real hard life out there. We all know how things are shrinking. And so, you know, it wasn't so much a tribute, a trumpet blast to the, wow, life is tough, as much as it's like, let's look just into these men and try to see what's going on. So I guess there's a number of communities.
As a writer, you know, people who work have always had a great ability to regard writing as something other than work. And these... since the people work so hard in this book, how do you explain to the people around you what it is you do, that it is in fact a job?
Writing for a long time with me, I mean, that's such a beautiful question, because life for a long time with me was not writing. You know, I always had a job. Even when I went to school, I was the kid working. I went to grad school, you know, nobody in my department had a real job. You know, they ran donuts down to the professors, and I had two of them because, You know, you want to send money home. You know, you want to do right by the people around you. And for a long time, writing didn't define me. When I had a reading a couple, 2 weeks ago in New York City, I had a lot of friends of mine who came up to me and were like, "My God, I never knew you were a writer." And it was a difficult thing for me to suddenly be, to realize that writing had become thrust to the forefront. You know, my family, they're old world from the Dominican Republic, mad suspicious of writing. They're like, "That's not a real job."
What were you studying in grad school?
I went for writing.
Uh-huh.
But for my mother was like, "Where are you at?" And I'm like, "I'm in an English department." And she goes, "Okay, then you'll be a teacher." And that was what was exciting for her.
Who did you study with?
I actually, I had a couple of professors up there. I had Elena Maria Viramontes, who's from the West.
She's from here, yeah.
Yes.
She's been on the show a couple of times.
She's a wonderful
woman.
She's
great. She's terrific. She's living in Cornell now, isn't
yep.
she? Yeah.
We hired her up there with student activism. We got a Latina hired.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of it, for me, there weren't that many mentors. If it wasn't for Elena, I would have been ass out. I would have been out in the cold, you know? So, you know, I got a lot of peers up there I met who were great people who were just like paying attention to hard work, like just putting a lot of time into the other students' writings, and that was good.
Elena spoke to me the last time she was here about a strong tear in her between providing role models in fiction, you know, addressing the absence of books that she had to read and had to give others to read, and the fact that all that Sandra Cisneros' books are now used as textbooks, and her own first book, Moths, because the stories are short, are used, and coming to a terrible sense of the ugliness of the life that she was writing, that it was not redeemable by writing, that you couldn't put a halo around it. Did you have any problems like that?
It was weird because, you know, when I was writing, I wasn't thinking so much that this was going to be of interest to many people. I didn't think that this was going to be picked up for textbooks. When I was writing it, I was just trying to like work at that short story art, which is a really tough art, man. I'm sure you know, and other people will tell you, like, it's not an easy monster. So I wasn't even thinking about those things, you know?
Uh-huh.
I was just like, do I got my neighborhood down? Are these real people? You know, have I given enough to my readers? Am I trusting my reader enough? Am I doing enough work? And then, you know, now that the book is out, I realized that it's, you know, life ain't easy. My mother says life ain't easy and life is big, you know? And so I think that these characters, you know, it's hard to put a halo around them.
The book is Drown by my guest, Juno Diaz. It gives signs, the book, of having at one time been a novel. Is that true, or just that the stories are interrelated?
No, it was never a novel. I wrote these as I wanted stories, and this was another challenge for me. I wanted stories that were interconnected in some way or the other, and then that resonated with each other. And then the way that the stories are ordered, I wanted to give a fuller feeling that it wasn't just 8 stories that I wrote, read them together because I wrote them. I wanted the stories to try to inform each other, to bleed into each other. And then really the last story in the collection, I wanted to, when you get done with the book, for you to have to go back to the beginning. Because
mm-hmm.
I feel like, you know, throughout the collection, we have this shadowy father who doesn't show up, you know, is always absent, always a tough guy, always a pain in the ass. And then suddenly at the end, you're given the father unfettered, unmediated, direct. And, you know, he's a tough, hard ass and a difficult man. And you see him, and then maybe as a reader, you reevaluate and go back and temper some of the criticisms you might have had. You might have the same ones, but at least you'll think about them. And that, for me, was what a good story collection should do. And that's why, you know, I mean, when you say that was this a novel, I mean, it makes me feel great, because I think that you can still call a group of stories stories. you don't have to do what happens a lot these days where people will just patch crap together and call it a novel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it took a lot of fighting with people for them to just say, okay, we're just going to make these stories.
One of the reviewers who I thought was pretty smart suggested there's a boy in Santo Domingo whose face has been eaten at by a hog, and he wears a mask. This reviewer suggested that this boy was a double or counterpoint for the narrator. Do you think about things like that?
I think instinctively. I'm a person who's, I think, drawn by instincts. And, you know, my instincts have been weaving things together for a long time. And I knew that I was drawn always to that kid without a face. And I knew how it resonated with me because, you know, I used to feel, when I was younger, I used to feel disfigured because, you know, I was a brown Dominican living in the United States, and people used to look at my face and there would be these reactions and I would think, my God, am I disfigured? You know? And so I'd always, you know, my heart was always out there for that. You know, I was open to that. And so again, that's a subconscious, wove those two together.
Who are the masters of the short story for you at this time?
You know, there's some brilliant, again, I think you have to look far because there's some people that write dope stories, just fantastic stories. I think Cisneros is a person who writes fantastic stories. I think a little Sung brother, Edward P. Jones, who came out from Morrow Books, is Lost in the City, unsung. A writer who was at Syracuse recently, from the Midwest, Michael Martone. Run out and get Michael Martone. He is remarkable. Short story, just remarkable.
Do you have a sense of community, of a writing community today?
Actually, I don't. You mean like, do I have writer friends?
Mm-hmm.
Nah. I was, you know, I didn't know writers. And even in my work when I was at school, I didn't know writers. I was, you know, known for my history. I was also known for community work. And so I didn't spend much time with writers.
Mm-hmm.
There was, you know, and now recently I've been meeting more writers, but I don't know. It seems to be, for me, in my heart, the less I'm around writers, the happier I am.
Why is that?
I mean, I don't know if it's because, you know, and I don't want to say this about all writers. I think that's a generalization. But, you know, I've met a lot. When I was in a prose writing program, they were all so competitive with each other and spent so much time stabbing each other in the back that it was difficult to form a community. Because I'm a person, you drop them off somewhere, and I immediately start building community. I'm mm-hmm. like, I reach out to people. I'm like, you need help? You know, you need me to read this stuff? That's fine. I'll put in work. We're here for that. And it was kind of hard there because people were competitive and bad-mouthing. And, you know, that's not all writers, but I have the same friends I've had for like 15 or 16 years, and they weren't writers, so I've been sticking by them. I know a lot of poets.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly I have to back up.
Mm-hmm.
Poets. Whew. Know a lot of poets. Brilliant.
Now, what gave you, you know, if you were not a part of that, what made you go to graduate school in writing?
A professor. I had an undergraduate. I had a wonderful professor. And he said, you know, you're great at history. I'm not going to lie. You know, you could go do history, maybe. And he goes, but you got some good stories. Go apply for an MFA. You want a time off? Well, this is like time off. You just have time off to write.
Mm-hmm.
He sort of kind of tricked me because I didn't know nothing about MFAs at all. And, you know, I really admired him. So I said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And he goes, you don't have to work in the steel mill and you don't have to deliver pool tables, which were my options
mm-hmm.
after college. And so I was like, well, that's a good one. You know, that's something I think I'll do. And so I applied and I got in, which was remarkable because so many places said no to me. I applied to like 6 places, 5 of them, like Ma and Pa MFA was like, no. And then Cornell out of nowhere said yes. And then you learn about luck.
Now, when you were writing these stories, I assume that there was a sort of workshop process, yes?
You know, universities are peculiar places. I ain't gonna lie to you. I mean, when I was there, the stories that were published in some of the bigger magazines were stories that people told me to throw away. They were like, oh, this has been done before. Ah, we don't need to see this anymore. Ah, this is boring. And you got to have instincts, because I kept thinking, my God, if I didn't have these instincts, if I didn't have friends outside saying, nah, man, you know what you're doing. You know, you're a good person. You've got heart and you're trying real hard to be honest and not to hurt people. You know what you're doing. Go for it. If I didn't have these people doing it, you know, I wonder if I might have listened to some of these critiques. And I think that that's one of the dangers that you have. I mean, you know, you got so many MFA programs out there. There's a huge proliferation. They're not all of the same quality. It's hard, you know. Even some of the ones with a great name, you know, they're dangerous for writers. There's too much competition. I think for students out there, just listen to your heart and, you know, watch out for the competition. Don't get taken out. You're probably doing something smart. I mean, when I got finished with my MFA, I swear to you, you couldn't have dragged me back into a program. You would have to shoot me through both legs and hook me, you know, and then drag me before I would go back.
The last question I want to ask is the question about English. The book begins with an epigraph from the Cuban poet Gustavo Perez Firmat, and it brings up the question that English itself falsifies the subject of the work, yes? But in what way?
You know, that's a killer. That's those lines in that opening are killers.
Well, let's begin. You should read the poem. It's not fair not to hear you. Go.
The poem is, it's an excerpt from a Gustavo Perez Firmat poem, and it says, "The fact that I am writing to you in English already falsifies what I wanted to tell you. My subject, how to explain to you that I don't belong to English, though I belong nowhere else." That came out of, you know, anyone who's spoke a first language that wasn't English, you know, who spoke, for example, I spoke Spanish first. And, you know, I lived my life in Spanish, steeped in a Spanish culture. I came to the United States. I learned English was my dominant language, my dominant public language. I still came home to my neighborhood and spoke Spanish in my family. A lot of my life was conducted in Spanish, you know, and it wasn't recognized as a language. When I went to school, it wasn't recognized. If I said something in Spanish, it was not recognized. If I repeated my mother's words in Spanish, it was not recognized. They were said, say it in English, you know, break her down and translate her into what we'll accept. And I had these experiences, these parts of my life that I felt that I was translating back into English because I was English dominant. And I was, you know, again, I was breaking them down. And everybody will tell you when you translate, something is always lost in the translation. And I think that for me was... those few lines, I was just recognizing things that are lost. You know, I was actually paying tribute to them, acknowledging that there are fractions, these tiny pieces that are lost, and you can't recuperate. You can't. And I don't have the powers in Spanish to recuperate them fully. And English itself doesn't have the power within itself to recuperate them fully. And so I wanted to talk about that, and I want to talk about what it means to be, you know, in such a space where these two languages are like that.
Well, you know, writers, poets, dramatists are classically regarded as the custodians of the language. And I wonder, on the other hand, at the same time, every writer with a voice is regarded as creating his own language. I was wondering to what extent are you shaping English for the future, and to what extent is this English yours on the page?
You know, I think that, you know, the language we speak in our books, you know, a lot of times goes on and does nothing for the larger language. We can't be too arrogant, you know. I know plenty of writers who've reinvented languages, who break languages, who stretch them out, and it only happens between page one and page whatever, and then it's over. It doesn't resonate. I felt one thing about this book. I was documenting the language that I heard growing up, and the language that, you know, that wonderful English that I heard growing up, and trying to get it down on the page. And it acts sort of as a historical document, A, but also, you know, you get to play with English and remind people how full and how alive English is. Like, English is always has three or four competing Englishes in it. Mm-hmm. It always has had it. And it's a good memory for people to realize this.
Anna Castillo, and this is very amusing to me, has been able to convince her publishers to include Spanish poems in her books, but not Spanish stories in her books of short fiction. It's as if the publishers are willing to say, well, you know, for a single page, a reader of English who doesn't know Spanish can look at a poem and be uncomprehending, but for the duration of an entire story, no. Do you have a war like that?
You know, I had it in some of my classes. I've had it with professors. I mean, for me, I don't write in Spanish, so I'm not going to, you know, I'm not challenging too much space. But the little space that I do challenge, that I want to play with, there's always been a war. People will be like, oh, put this in italics, which I refuse to do. Oh, translate a little more of this, which I think is not, you know, is not wise. I really trust my readers. I really do. I think that the average reader is, you know, willing to put up with a lot of things, willing to learn. And I think a lot of editors don't trust readers. They really dumb readers down. And, you know, this story, I've been around with this book a little bit, and I've seen that, you know, my faith in my readers is paying off. The people are willing to sit down, read through it, look up words they don't understand, reach out and speak to people, say like, oh, what does this mean?
Mm-hmm. When I was going to school, the most horrifying thing was sitting across from an alumnus of Cornell University. I was going to be an English major. And being told by him, since I spoke Spanish, that this would be good if I was going to be going into business, but not for someone interested in literature.
Yes.
And, you know, you look around now, of course, and someone would have to be, you know, an idiot or with his head in the ground to still say that kind of thing, but it was once common.
Yeah, and I still think, you know, in some places it's still common. It's, you know, a lot of times our culture gets reduced down to, like, frivolity or commerce. And so, you know, I think it's good for people to push that and to shape it and to beat it and to show that how that's wrong.
I've been speaking to Juno Diaz, the author of a first book of stories, Drown, recently published by Riverhead. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Jennifer Swadek. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Wow.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.